Hey, everybody, what's going on? This is Seth with SethPerler.com and the Executive Function Online Summit, and I'm here today with Dr. Dan Peters, and we are going to, Dr. Dan is a psychologist, he's an author, and he's co-founder and executive director of the Summit Center, and his career is all about assessment and treatment of children, adolescents, and families, and he specializes in overcoming worry and fear, learning differences, and issues related to giftedness in 2E. And he has a parenting podcast called Parent Footprint, or that's part of the name, and an online parenting community, and has done many, many other things. So without further ado, I want to introduce Dr. Dan, and how you doing today?
Good, Seth. Happy to be talking.
Awesome. I'm super excited. What are parents going to learn today?
All right, today you are going to learn about the way the brain and body connection exists with the fight and flight response, which actually explains a lot of the ways our kids act and feel and behave. We're going to learn specific strategies for identifying and working on what we're going to call the worry monster, different levels of anxiety and fear. We're going to learn about thinking strategies, mindfulness strategies, and behavior strategies to come up with a targeted approach to taking down worry and fear.
Awesome. One of the most popular blogs on my site is the one about anxiety. So I know that this is a super big topic for people to hear about. The name of your talk today is Turning Worriers into Warriors, Teaching Coping, Problem Solving, and Resiliency. So before we get into the bulk of it, let's do a little intro about you. So Dan, tell us about who you are outside of work. What are you interested in? Who are you as a typical human being?
As a human. Okay. So as a human being, I really enjoy nature and the outdoors. I find that things make a ton of sense when we are connected to the natural world. And particularly with what I do, I spend a lot of time in this office and in the chair across the way there. And so getting outside is really important to me. I love to build. I love to make things. And I love to create and vision ideas, programs, just stuff. And then, of course, I like connecting with people who are important to me.
Awesome. Awesome. And then as far as professional background, what do we need to know about you today, or what do you want to share?
I'm a licensed psychologist by training, and I've always worked throughout my training and career with children, adolescents, and families. And really the core of helping children and adolescents and parents understand those people in a way that maximizes growth and potential. I always had a problem in graduate school and beyond with the medical pathologizing view of human nature and human behavior, and always struggled with how are we trying to help people be better versions of themselves when we give them labels that only focus on their deficits and their problems. So something that's just been important to me in my work over the years has been how to create a strength-based and realistic understanding of oneself, understanding what your strength profile is, accepting what the challenges is, which is, I know, a lot of what this summit is about, and then finding ways to build skills so you could still reach your goal feeling good about who you are.
Okay, that just opened like 700 Pandora's boxes that I want to do follow-up questions with, but we are not going to get into all those follow-up questions. But I do want to ask, how did you get into this? Why is this important to you?
Well, like most things, things ultimately become personal. The drive becomes personal. And I think, you know, like you, knowing how wonderfully you share your story, it took me a while to realize how much worry and perfectionism actually impacted my life growing up. And it didn't all come to a head probably until towards the end of graduate school early in my career, when I realized and resonated with so many of my clients who were experiencing worry, perfectionism, and fear that, wow, this is something that I experience. And then having young children and seeing my children experience these things, it all coalesced into this mission to help people understand first and then learn how to overcome and manage worry and anxiety, because I know firsthand how much it limits us, paralyzes us, and keeps us from living fully. So it ended up being a 360 with myself, my clients, my kids, and then the other thing, being a perfectionist in recovery, I like to call it, is I like to see things get done. I need to see progress. And so as a psychologist sitting day in and day out with people, I need to see change, because that's what I feel my job is, help people realize their goals. And what I found was helping people learn about anxiety, what it is, give them skills, help them develop a toolbox. There was, in many cases, almost immediate and incremental change. And so I just became passionate about, hey, this is information that works. And if you have this information, you're going to be able to move, because I know that I wish I didn't have to wait till age 25, 26, 27 to get this information myself. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We really seem to put ourselves in these situations, and then it's a mirror and it's mirrored back to us who we are. And then we can really dive, we can run from it, or we can really dive into it and really learn some amazing things to become the wounded healer. Have you heard of that before?
Definitely. Yeah.
The wounded healer, this idea that we help people with what we need help with oftentimes.
Right. And then the goal ultimately is just what was what we learned a lot in graduate school was the goal is also to heal those wounds. So when you're out there healing your own personal wounds, experience is not being projected onto others.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. I want to ask you about one more thing, even though I could ask you about 50 from the little intro here, because I think it's really relevant before we dive in deeper. And that was that you used the word pathologizing. And for parents who have never heard that word, and you're referencing how that really was a turnoff to you and you wanted to go a different direction, can you unpack that whole concept of pathologizing the other direction you were going just a little bit more?
Sure. So if we just take a step back, psychiatry and then psychology coming out of psychiatry coming out of medicine, everything within the medical community historically has been, you need to identify the pathology or the disease, and then you treat the disease, which of course makes sense with cancer or diabetes and all the other various physical ailments that we humans get. Where there seemed to be over time a disconnect is when we're dealing with challenges with behavior, challenges with emotional regulation, which I know we'll be talking about, challenges with, let's say, executive functioning, and everything is put into a label which denotes only that you have a problem that needs to be fixed. What happens is there is a heavy dose, like in the in medicine, a heavy dose of this is what's wrong with you and we need to fix what's wrong with you. And within the human development, the world of psychology, it leaves out the whole other part of a person, which is all of the strengths and all of the drive and all the other stuff that we can build when we're, instead of being over-focused on a problem and telling a person or a child they have a problem, which does not create, I think, a positive foundation for self-efficacy, for self-confidence, and for growth. So we try to get away from, you have this problem. We want to identify weaknesses and challenges. And sorry, let me say one more thing. Labels and diagnoses are very useful. For example, ADHD, of course, is going to be a very common diagnostic category for people who have executive functioning issues. That's not to say that those things don't matter. It's how do we use those labels to describe behavior, but then really think differently about how we focus on supporting growth and development.
So do we misuse labels?
I think what we do is they get overused and then the label then, it's like that saying, to define is to destroy. It all of a sudden, so if you tell a teacher this child has ADHD, each teacher has an absolute snapshot of what that means and could mean very little for that individual child.
Right, through their lens.
through their lens.
Everybody has, yeah.
Right. So I think it does get overused, and I do think it gets oversimplified.
One of the coolest things about these interviews so far is the recurring themes that are coming. And one is that labels have a purpose, but we need to really use them for the purpose that they're intended for and not overuse them and read too much into them, but actually use it to help us figure out useful information to help a human being. And then another one about the pathologizing and how, and then also what you're about to talk about how we're sort of neglecting to look at this whole other aspect of a human being and thinking that, yeah, we can find some quick fixes and stuff, but there's some real depth going on here that we want to dive into. Sorry mm-hmm. I hope I didn't interrupt you too much there.
Not at all.
So can you give us your definition of executive function? Do you have a one sentence definition and can you unpack that?
I've been thinking about that question, and what I've come up with is, for me, executive functioning is the ability to regulate one's emotions and behaviors.
And what does that mean?
That means it's the ability to have metacognition, be able to think about your thinking, so you have the ability to pause and plan a behavior or manage an emotion. So I think about it in terms of a tool. And again, there's always exceptions to this in life, which, you know, this is, we'll talk about why we have the fear responses to not be able to do that, to keep us alive from being eaten by a saber-toothed tiger. However, outside of that, my experience is those who have executive functions that are developed and continue to grow are able to think about a response and plan a response as opposed to just doing something without giving it some pre-thought.
Okay, awesome. So along those lines, if you're working with one of your clients and they come in and in your mind you're saying, wow, that kid's really struggling with X, Y, and Z, and one of the things they're struggling with is executive function, what do they look like when they start working with you? Maybe you can even think of one of your clients or one of your people. What do they look like when they start working with you and they're really struggling? I guess, what does it look like when they're struggling with executive function? And then you've worked with them and taken them to point B where you can breathe a sigh of relief and go, okay, this kid is going to be okay. We've really helped them turn a corner. What's right. sort of that journey like in your work?
Well, so what I often find is when a child, adolescent, any age comes in, and of course, the older the individual, the more ability for the metacognition they'll have, the more reflection ability they'll generally have, is there's problems and things feel out of control and chaotic and bad things are happening with teachers and parents, but they don't know why fully and they don't know what to do about it. So the first process is trying to unpack what are the things that are going wrong and is there a pattern? I never know what my assignments are. I'm blurting out when I'm upset. I'm barging in on friends. I procrastinate and I just stay on my electronics and I don't do any work. So it's starting to develop what are the things that are happening and what are the patterns. And then this is a key point. Is there any desire to change those things? Because I know that, like in your experience too, like if we often get kids who parents bring them in, parents say, you need help, but we're not going to get anywhere if there is not that connection with the individual that I do want something to be a little different and I'm open to trying some things differently, even if they're not going to work. So first step is what are the patterns and awareness about the patterns. Next to, do you want to do anything about them? And then a lot of kids do, you know, they can't always do it, but they want to. And then the next step is what are these one, two or three things that you're going to try and report back and see if there's any change. And what we find is from those one, two or three things, one thing might work. They might forget, but then the question is, do you want to try something again differently? And I find that you have to be very prescribed and concrete because it's when something is prescribed in concrete, a child or adolescent can actually see how writing in my planner or checking my planner or putting my clothes out the night before I go to bed actually creates a response that feels good. And then is, it builds. So, I would say then the question is you have an active participant in the work and you then have parents who are then supporting that plan with the child who is on board versus one that's being dragged into a situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there has to be that buy-in. I talk about I use the word resistance a lot, and mm-hmm. the resistance will still be there even with buy-in, but you have to have some buy-in.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're a professional or a parent or a teacher that doesn't start there, you know, then adults resort to shame and punishment and things that really don't work. And they certainly don't work in the long term if they appear to in the short term. So let's see. I guess before we get into, I want to start talking about some of the bullet points that you wanted to cover. But before we get into that, can I ask you, Dan, what are some of the biggest blind spots or myths or misunderstandings that the adults come in with?
And would you say related to executive functioning or related to the topic of our worry and worry monster?
Let's do one of each. What's a big one that people come in with executive function and one about worrying?
Well, I think in my experience, the biggest one about executive functioning is if a person just tried, then everything would be fine. And it's really just a lack of effort. It's willfulness, lack of willfulness, effort. And I think that's the most painful one to experience. And it's the most common. And it's the only time where I see it pivot is when you have a parent who has or had the same experiences. And there's a ton of empathy in the situation. But most of the time, it's just a lack of will, a lack of effort, and they don't care. And I think that's the most painful one that kids experience is when they hear adults tell them, you don't even care. And you have these kids that say, I do care, but caring is different than engaging in behaviors.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful. And then,
For worry, I think that's a tough one. I think here's what, it's hard for people who have not experienced worry and anxiety to understand and empathize about the impact of that anxiety is having on their child or their spouse. And so it usually gets minimized and you hear the, just do it. It's not a big deal. Stop worrying. And unless you've been that person, you don't know how crazy that statement is. And I'm thinking about this college student that I've been seeing who he's went through a terrible bout of anxiety out of nowhere, a terrible 6 months. And the other day I said, and he's coming out of it and he's really doing well. And I said, what have you learned from this experience? And he said, well, the amount of empathy I have for people experience anxiety, I'm going to call this old friend of mine who in high school had so much anxiety. And I was just kept telling her to stop worrying and just fuck up. So I think there's just there needs to be a ton of empathy for people who worry and have anxiety and fear because it's not anything anyone wants and it can be totally debilitating.
It can be debilitating. I think that's a really important statement because as you said, we'll say, just stop worrying, just get over it, you know?
Yeah.
And that reminds me of what you said about executive function, that it's just a matter of willfulness. If you just try hard enough, you can stop. And I was in a coma and then my lungs stopped and then I started having panic attacks. I don't know if you know the story, but for 3 years and I couldn't believe it. Talk about debilitating. Like it was, I could be in a grocery store and having a full on anxiety attack and nobody even knows. And that's really scary with a lot of these kids sitting in a classroom and nobody can visibly see it. Or I guess if you're more in tune with it and attuned to the students, you can start to, but a lot of times you got 50 minutes, you got 30 kids and there's a kid,
right.
Multiple kids that are really suffering. So Should we get into the components of the brain and body responsible for the fear response?
Yes, I think
what's the fear response?
Okay, so the fear response. So here, so everything I talk about today, I just want to quickly say how I stumbled upon this approach, which again is not necessarily anything that I created, a psychoeducational approach, with a very bright client that I've been seeing for years about his anxiety, and very little seemed to be working. And one day after a session, so this particular session, I just was running out of ideas. So I pulled down the brain and I told them how the fight and flight response worked. It was like the last 15 minutes of the session. Again, I've known him for years. And his mom emails me and says, I don't know what you did in the session, but he said it was by far the most helpful meeting he has ever had with you. And I realized, oh my gosh, like we're not giving kids this information about how things work in our human body. So this is where this part of the process came from. So I've got the brain. This is what I usually bring out. And what we teach kids is that there's a difference between fear and anxiety. So fear is what we need to stay alive. Fear, we have fear built into our brain and our body, so we can react immediately without thought, you know, without executive functioning, to jump when there's a snake, run away from a saber-toothed tiger, and fight another tribe who's trying to take our family and our stuff. That's why we have it. And what we want to tell kids is that this thing in our brain, which I'm trying to take off right now, here we go, this thing in our brain, this little thing right there is called the amygdala. It's tiny, tiny. I had one client who say, oh my gosh, I must have a really big amygdala, right? But it's tiny compared to this giant frontal lobe where we have housed most of our executive functioning and our frontal lobe functions and our captain of our ship. This thing is way bigger, which is why we want to really use this frontal lobe to override this amygdala. So what happens is our amygdala is always sensing. It's always sensing for danger with one job, to keep us alive. Now, when it gets triggered, quickly something happens. It sends a message to our adrenal glands to start producing massive amounts of adrenaline, massive amounts, so we can be superhuman fighting or running machines just to survive. So when this happens, our heart starts beating way out of our chest. Blood is pumping to get our blood with the adrenaline to our extremities to fight and to run, but yet it needs blood from our largest organs. So what happens, it takes blood from our stomach and shuts down our stomach, because we say, do we need to digest nachos while we're running for our life? No. So, but when the blood leaves our stomach, what happens is we get physiological symptoms of cramping, stomach aches, tingling, having to go to the bathroom, and this is, think about the things you hear your kids say. I have a stomach ache. I don't feel well. I'm nauseous. Okay. Then what happens is the most amount of blood is in our brain. We don't need to solve complex math problems when we're running for our life. Brain shuts down to the most minimum amount of blood supply that it needs, and all the blood goes through our heart into our arms and our legs. Now, so what symptoms do we get in our brain? We get headaches. We get lightheaded. We get dizzy. This is like the test anxiety. I'm afraid I'm going to fail a test. And then, of course, all the blood leaves your brain and then you can't remember anything. So it's this self-fulfilling prophecy. So that's the head responses that we usually see with the physiological symptoms of headache, all that stuff. Now, here's the other thing, which is interesting for kids to know, is, and I put this on the kid video, that it goes to our arms and our legs. So what happens, all the blood goes to our arms and our legs, but then we get this tingling sensation in our arms and our legs and sometimes sweatiness. And this is so the blood goes to our arms and our legs, but it leaves the surface of our skin so we can be wounded in battle and not bleed to death, which is really cool in like a Viking movie, right? And so we tell kids, do you need this superhuman ability while you're trying out for the play, while you're taking a test, while you're going to a new situation? So what happens again is that we have these active amygdalas. Now, here's where the most important information I think comes in. What triggers the amygdala a large majority of the time? It is our worrisome thoughts, right? So where fear is fear is the physical response to a stimulus to survive. Anxiety and worry is generally what we say in irrational fear. You're going to leave and never pick me up. I'm going to fail this test and never get into college. No one's going to talk to me at the birthday party. I'm never going to get on the good team. Right? So when we have this trigger, this we call this the cognitive model of psychology, that triggers the amygdala. So I can be sitting here and talking to you, Seth, and all of a sudden, I can't find a word, which happens to me quite a bit. I could roll with it, try to find it, make a joke, be real. Or I could start to think, I don't know what I'm talking about. I'm blowing it. I'm supposed to know stuff. Seth's going to push this out to all these people, and I don't even know what I'm talking about. That would start to produce the fear response in me, which then produces the shutdown. So what we have to help kids be aware of is there is thinking that a large majority of the time produces that thought. And we want to help the kids. We talked about earlier with executive functioning, with metacognition. We want to help a child and adolescent think about their thinking, ask the question, what am I thinking right now? Then I realize I'm coming off at any time here. I'm on a roll though.
And you're speaking my language. So,
okay.
So I'm really resisting saying anything because everything you say, I want to say, oh yeah. And I see it in this way too. And this perfect. Cool.
Okay. So what happens is if we can think about our thinking and ask ourselves the question, what am I thinking? Oh, I'm thinking that I'm never going to catch up on my reports and everyone's going to be upset with me. I could take a deep breath and say, is that true? Am I never going to pick up? Okay, no, I actually have 3 reports to do. Okay, how much time do I have left? Well, I have 3 hours in the day. What if I don't finish it? Well, I could do it later tonight or I could wake up early in the morning. Okay, will people really be mad at me? No, they won't be mad at me. The ones that I don't finish, I can email. They told me that it'd be okay if I was running behind. So what this becomes is resiliency and self-talk skills, which is an executive functioning technique to talk yourself through a situation, which then will turn down your amygdala when you don't need it. Now, again, we need it on when we see a stick that looks like a snake or a car drives by real fast or someone jump scares us. We need our amygdala to help us freak out so we can survive. The rest of the time, we really need to do our best to think through what we're thinking that is often producing our internalized experience.
Awesome. So I guess to reiterate in slightly different words for the audience. So parents, if your child makes mountains out of molehills, or if they have a perception that the thing is bigger than it really is, and it feels like a 10 to them, but you know from an outsider's perspective, it's only a 2. What happens is that our brain tells us, oh, there's this threat, or the amygdala says, oh, there's a threat, and our story just believes it and goes with it and doesn't question it. But stopping to be metacognitive or self-reflective or self-aware or mindful or conscious of what's going on in the mind, pausing to do that allows us to say, whoa, is that really true? And then we can start to tell the amygdala, dude, that's actually not the way it is. There are other ways to look at it, and we can start to have tools to re-regulate the nervous system and to stop signaling the heart to be set, or the adrenals to be sending adrenaline to the heart and be prepping for fight or flight. And
yes, beautiful. The other thing that you hit on, which was is the next thing I was thinking about, is you said mindful. So the 3 main approaches, cognitive, the thinking part that we just talked about, and self-talk is another one of those, like the little engine that could, I think I can.
So influential.
The second one is mindful, and the third one is behavioral. So mindfulness, this is something that I also would have loved to have this information when I was young, particularly middle school. I remember this would have been very helpful. All worry and fear exist in the future. All worry and fear and anxiety exist in the future. It exists on something that has not yet happened. What if there's an earthquake? What if you leave me? What if I fail the test? What if I don't get picked?
It's always a what if.
what if, right? So I should have said that. So that, so for the cognitive part, it's always the what if thoughts. Thank you. So if everything is in the future, the antidote to worry and fear, anxiety, is living in the present.
Very well put.
And if there's one thing, if you're going to ask me that question, I don't know, I'm saying it now. There's one thing that I tell clients is if you can ground yourself in the present moment, take a deep breath and say, yeah, everything's fine right now. I know I'm worrying about what's going to happen this weekend, but I'm going to wait for this weekend. I'm just going to think about right now, everything's fine. And that is the ultimate mindfulness. You do that, that's mindfulness. People think you have to meditate for hours. It's really grounding yourself and taking some breaths and just being present right now. The other thing that's a very helpful mindful strategy is letting thoughts pass. This is like another meditative technique that you can do informally. So I always think of us Westerners, we're like King Kong on the building with airplanes. Like, so if those are our thoughts, we're fighting those airplanes, all these anxious, worrisome thoughts. The mindful approach is letting the thoughts pass, like the Toyota Sail-a-thon plane or the county fair, you know, bzz, it flies by, you notice it. And then bzz, it flies by again, you notice it. By the third time, you don't even notice it anymore. So what I was taught by a mentor of mine when I was having worrisome thoughts was to say, interesting, I'm thinking that right now, and let it go instead of tackling it. So I think my teaching kids and adolescents and practicing it ourselves as adults is so huge to stay grounded in the moment. And that is another, again, executive function, because what you're able to do is shift your attention for something you're worried about out there to something right here and now.
And it's really hard because we've practiced the worry. We've worked very hard to make neural connections about the stories and the narratives that were the what ifs that were sort of catastrophizing here, right? Yep. So to get into the moment is a practice. But one of the things you said at the very, very beginning is, I forget how you worded it, but you said something about how, I think you said two things at the same time. It takes a lot to change, but on the other hand, it takes very little to change. Like, it's remarkable how taking little time, can you tell us a little bit about that in this situation? Yeah. Because it does, you know, like I had anticipatory anxiety. I didn't even know what that was after the coma, where I would think about, my fear and become afraid. I'd be like, oh, I wonder if I'll be anxious today. Oh, I just found a reason to start being anxious today. Let's go down that rabbit hole, and it would just overtake me. So
yeah, exactly. And anticipatory anxiety is such a common form of anxiety that, as you point out, people don't even know what that is, right? It's like, it's the worry. It's the fear about the fear, or worry about the worry. Okay. So small things go a long ways when you get what I call victories. Like, what we're trying to do is help kids have little victories. So a little victory could be, I'm worried about the tryouts on Thursday. Okay. What is going on right now? Nothing. Is there anything you can do about the tryouts on Thursday right now? No. Is there anything you can do about the tryouts after school? Yeah, I think if I practice my free throws, I'll feel better. Okay. So when you can take a tangible action, whether it's take a belief and change a belief, or alter a current moment worry by putting it somewhere, you actually start to build this foundation of success and confidence that you believe, okay, I haven't solved this yet, but you know what? I was able to concentrate in school this hour, or I was able to forget about it and not be stressing and obsessing over it. So that's just one example of a building block, but I think I want to give the next example, which leads to the behavioral interventions, because I think this is where it's the most tangible, concrete, and observable, is when you identify a worry or a fear, and then you break it down into little bite-sized pieces and then you take an action against the worry or against the worry monster. Oh, you know what? I realize I haven't even introduced a worry monster. Hold on.
So as he's getting the worry monster, I will reiterate this concept too. Like for me, I always say that baby steps are everything. I want kids to have micro successes. And it's hard because it, on the one hand, it takes a semester or two to see a big shift with kids when I'm in my work. But when I'm doing that, everything that gets us there are so tiny. And sometimes we miss those, but those are everything. So anyhow.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And so that fits perfectly with behavioral baby steps. And, you know, we all remember that movie, What About Bob, with Bill Murray, like classic movie where he was taking these actual behavior, you know, one step at a time. And it's so true. So if you identify being afraid of dogs, let's just use it being afraid of dogs. So a lot of people are afraid of dogs. A lot of kids are afraid of dogs. And it actually can become a pervasive family changing fear when all of a sudden you cannot go to a park, to a friend's house, anywhere where there might be a dog. So when you're taking on this fear, you can do what's called a success ladder. And a success ladder is where you break down the fears within that one fear of, let's say, petting a dog would be at the top, the most fearful. And the bottom, like number 10 on the rung, might be looking at a picture of a dog. And what you do is you start at the bottom, and you often have to use an incentive program with the kids, because how many of us really choose to overcome fear? It's terrible, right? So you need to have something that's a little carrot out there. That's the way that we humans work, to say, if you can look at this picture, this book of dogs for 2 minutes, you know what? We'll go get a yogurt. And again, it start with something that they don't really want to do, but they can do. And
it
all of a sudden,
it has to be attainable, something that they can.
We're not pushing them into the pool, right? That's called flooding. That technique is considered unethical, right?
Like tiny bite.
Tiny bites. Anyway, so you work your way up and you get the success. And what you're doing with your neurochemistry is you can't be afraid and bored at the same time. And what happens, kids go, okay, I'm done. This is stupid, right? Okay, I've looked at a picture of a book. Now what? But they weren't able to do that before. And then it's the next one is, hey, we're going to go. What would you like to do? Would you like to go to a pet store that has dogs and we'll stand outside the window? Do you want to go in the car to a park that has dogs and we'll stay in the car? And you just keep working your way up. And I can't tell you how many people have been so fearful of this, and at the end of it are petting dogs and getting one as a pet. So it's all these building confidence and baby victories and baby steps.
Can I point out something also, a technique that you also just did, whether you know it or not, but something that I call a false choice. So parents watching, you can also take this idea of this false choice where he gave two choices. Would you rather do this or this? There are many, many, many choices, and they have a choice of saying none of them, but he didn't present it that way. And he gave two very small chunks. So much of what we do, what all of us professionals do, is chunk things down into bite-sized pieces that kids are willing to take an emotional risk. This is an emotional experience for them. We have to understand that that's going on underneath the surface. Absolutely. So we have to make them feel safe to take the risk.
Yes. Safe to take the risk so they can have a success. If they, you know, right, these are kids who are used to not feeling in many ways successful, and feeling afraid of failing again. So we do have to set that up, as you're saying, Seth, so there can be a success, a high five, a smile, and then all of a sudden there's a willingness to take another risk.
Anybody watching, I just want you to know, this is so how I operate. This is how I often say that my job is to lead a horse to water and get them to drink. Mm-hmm. We are trying to help them bust through their own resistances for their own future well-being so that they can have this resilience. And this is fantastic. And you had mentioned so that they can feel success. Can you speak a little bit to feeling success in the body? Like you talked about feeling anxiety in the body. I just want to connect that dot for people to know that when you said that, I don't want that to just drift by. Like, yeah, that's a really important statement to me, that that's a feeling too, that you and I and parents can capitalize on and make bigger. Like that high five is so important. It's not just, we need to help them connect the dot, the metacognition. Can you speak to that?
Yeah. So to see the success is one thing. To have a child feel it is a whole nother thing. And I'm just going to give you an example with my oldest, who's well represented in the first Warrior to Warrior book, because it exemplifies this. And I think it really obviously impacted me in my work with my clients. So she had a lot of different anxieties, a terrible anxiety walking into school by herself, preschool, kindergarten, first grade. I was doing baby steps with her for probably 3 years, like working the baby steps. I'll walk you to here. Finally get to this point in the school where there's this loop and you have to have the kids get out by themselves. You can't clog it up. And so we practiced with baby steps. We practiced with baby steps in the summer. Then we practiced with her cousin who went to school with her. And then the first week of school, they would allow you to have a little fudge it. So then we had a friend and a cousin. And it got to the point after all this practice, right? This we call the systematic desensitization, this baby steps, this building muscle. And it was just her friend and her cousin said they're going with their mom on the first day that she had to do it by herself. Now we're in line and it's packed, and I'm thinking, looking in the back through the rearview mirror, and I see her there with her glasses and her backpack next to her. And I'm like, "You got this, honey." She's like, "Mm-hmm." And then I'm like, "This is going to work." I turn into the point of no return where there's cars in front of you and behind you, and there's nowhere to go. And I see the look in her eyes, right? The fight and flight is on. And she says, "I'm not doing it." So now I get my fight and flight. I'm like, "What do you mean you're not doing it?" She's like, I'm not getting out. I'm like, "You have to get out." So now my frontal lobe is not fully working here. So we get close, and we're three cars away. She's like, "I'm not getting out." And she's a very strong-willed individual. And so I pull out my last stop, which was not a psychologist thing to say. I said, I saw the principal, and she tended to be kind of scary. So I said, "Sweetie, if you don't get out, I'm going to get in trouble with the principal." It just came out. So we pull up. She yells, "Fine." She grabs her backpack. She takes off her seatbelt and she walks in. And I'm sitting there like sweating, like breathing hard. But here's the moral of the story. My wife said, she kept saying for months, "It's stupid. Why do you care about me walking to school? It doesn't make a difference," right? Stupid, boring. She came home. She called everyone in the family and told them what she did. And from that moment on, she was ready and willing to engage in all of her other worries, like talking to people and looking them in the eye. She started practicing all of the other things she was resistant to, because my wife said she came out of school a foot taller. So I'm using that as an example, this feeling of, I did it, I can do it. It builds such internal confidence and fortitude that it's, I can do the next one too. And I don't know how else to describe it, but sort of this feeling. I don't know if you can expound on that, Seth, but it's just the thing, the image and vision that comes to me.
Yeah, the sort of clinical term that comes to mind is generalization, right?
Yeah.
So something happens and you can start to apply it to other areas. Mm-hmm. And also, as you're talking, what I'm thinking about is how much people wouldn't have seen how many tiny steps it got to get to that one step.
Right.
And I love that you didn't do it right. Yeah. Because I think parents need to know that you and I and all of us are human too. And it's messy and it's okay. And sometimes when you don't do it right, it even works.
Yes.
It's not what you're going for, but who cares? If it works, it works. And also her feeling that and sharing it with everybody, that really helped, again, on a somatic level, her excitement is so important for her nervous system and her physiology, and to retrain the brain or the amygdala, I'm not good at describing that, but to at least retrain it to start to say, oh, this world isn't as scary as my story was telling me.
Exactly.
And that's, I guess, resilience.
Yeah, exactly. It's resilience. And that thank you for making that connection. So when I spent a lot of time talking about anxiety over the years and working with anxiety, and the bridge that I've been making is exactly what you just said. all the literature on resilience and the skills that one needs to be resilient are virtually the same techniques from overcoming anxiety and fear. Metacognition, think about your thinking, identify what the problem is, come up with solutions, and then engage in a behavior to figure out what that problem is. And if it doesn't work, try a different one. Like, that's resilience. And that is anxiety, anti-anxiety training. And it goes so hand in hand. And these are the skills that we feel so strongly that kids should be learning. This is far more important than knowing the capitals of all the states in America for life success.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, you're saying things that other speakers have said in that statement. There's so much repetition, which is so good for parents to hear. You got 5 minutes. I got two questions for you.
Okay.
One, which I think will be good because for anything that you missed, you hopefully can answer it with this question. And then, so I maybe take 3 minutes on this and two on the last one. So the first question is, what actions, based on your knowledge and everything you've learned in your career, what actions can parents take this week to start implementing some of your theories and practices? And is there books or websites or your work, or where should parents start? What action should they take?
Well, I think, so the first thing is really to understand the situation that your child, really trying to work to understand that the situation your child is in. Of course, this sounds self-serving. This is why I wrote the books. The main book is From Worrier to Warrior. And what it does is it's a guide to help overcome your child's fears. There is a companion book called From Warrior to Warrior, which is written to older youth and teens. And then there's a workbook, the Warrior Workbook, for younger kids. All of that is laid out to explain this and normalize this process for this is how the brain and body works. Identify what are the physical indicators that your child has. Is it headache? Is it stomach ache? Is it avoidance? Is it fight? Right? Like, usually this oppositionality, it's anxiety. That's what's underneath it. So understanding what your child's indicators are, and then telling them, hey, I've learned some really valuable information. I want to talk to you. Something that I didn't even fully know. It's about how our brain and body works. And you sit down and you talk to them, and then you help them get on board for, is there something that you would like to do to help make this fictional worry monster? And if they're older kids and adolescents, they can name it other things that are funnier and more crass. Whatever resonates, so they can get on board and buy into, I want this to go away. I want to have a sleepover. I don't want to be afraid when you're gone. And say, we can work on this together. Because the whole point is you need a team. And then in the book, in the resources, in the parent, the template that I forwarded, and for the kids, there's those are other resources that really are just totally aligned with what I'm talking about as a step-by-step way to work through it with their kids.
Awesome. Awesome. Thank you. That's great. And then the last question is from your heart to theirs. So there are people watching right this second, concerned parents, who are really trying to understand these struggles. From your heart to theirs, what's the most important thing you hope that they walk away with right now?
The most important thing is hope, and that this worry and anxiety and fear is treatable, actionable, and one can live with it, manage it, and overcome it, right? The reason I'm saying in that way, everyone has a different dose for different reasons. You have to have hope that these strategies and addressing it with your child to give them these life skills, you can see growth and change, and you can all gang up together to keep worry, the worrying monster, down low, small, out of your child's life, so it's not keeping him or her from living. And I also want to say to you parents, as a parent and as a human, all this stuff applies to us too. And one of the most important things we can do is work on our own anxieties and fears, even in concert with our kids, because they love to know that we're human too.
Awesome. That was amazing. Thank you so much, Dan. And for all your parents out there, go take action. And thanks again for sharing your time and expertise with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for putting this on.
All right, Dan, take care. Hey, everybody. I just got done speaking with Dr. Dan Peters from the Summit Center. And I realized that in this talk, so he had a hard stop. He had to get off the call, but I realized that I did leave something perhaps that you want me to complete the story, and that is the coma story. So I'm not going to go too into depth, and I don't talk about it a lot, but it's such an important event in my life. So I was in a coma for 9 days. I come out of it. I had lost most of my body weight. My body had eaten most of itself. I lost 35 pounds in the 9 days. I was just skinny as twigs, and I couldn't walk. I had to relearn how to walk again. I couldn't speak for the first day because I was intubated, yada, yada. So I go through this experience. I start having these afterwards anxiety and panic attacks. During the coma, I couldn't breathe. So my panic attacks and anxiety attacks had everything to do with I can't breathe. So I might be on a bicycle, feel like I'm getting out of breath. I would start having a panic attack and say, oh my gosh, I'm getting out of breath. My lungs haven't healed completely. Am I going to die? And I would have all of this anxiety and panic around this. So I got a counselor, therapist that couldn't prescribe medicine because what the doctors had told me was to get on this medication, and I didn't want to get on medication. I wanted to see if I could learn to work with it without it, and I'm so glad I did. Now, I'm not saying medication isn't right for some people with anxiety, but I think it's a very important question to look at very deeply. I didn't want to do it. I wanted to see if there's another way. I got a therapist who couldn't prescribe. I had no idea what she was going to do, but what ended up happening is she taught me about mindfulness meditation. And the first book that she introduced me to was by Thich Nhat Hanh, and I can't even remember what the name of it is, but The Miracle of Mindfulness, I think, is what it was. But I started learning to meditate, and I didn't even do it well. I legitimately have ADD. I'm somebody who thought, oh, I can't meditate because I can't stop thinking. I had the biggest misunderstanding about meditation, and I started meditating sometimes a minute, 3 minutes, 5 minutes, just a little bit, and it was my best effort. It was not 20 or 30 minutes or hours or anything like that, but it was enough to start to change my brain. Now, I also went to my therapist about the anxiety and panic. I also did a lot of journaling and reading books about it and reaching out for all kinds of help to deal with it. But I will say that the mindfulness meditation was the number one thing that I believe helped me change my brain, where my amygdala didn't live in this place where it just thought that we were being threatened all the time, and where I could hear the story, the narrative, the cognitive piece that Dr. Dan was talking about, where I could start to hear these stories that I had, and I could start to say, yeah, I'm not buying it. I don't think I'm going to die today because I can't get enough oxygen. I bet I'll be okay. You know, I started having a different inner dialogue. The worry monster, as he calls it, started shrinking. And so I just wanted to conclude with this. That's been many years ago. I have no anxiety today. I probably have anxiety 3 or 4 times a year for about a minute, and it's gone. And this was something that was daily in my life. It was debilitating. I wouldn't go places or do certain things because of it. And I was a school teacher at the time. And when my brain was engaged and I was in school and I'm working with kids, I didn't have anxiety. When I'm hanging with friends and doing fun things, it was when I was in my own head that I would have these anxieties. And I do not live with that today. So I'm telling you, 3 solid years of anxiety and panic, and it started to finally fade after that, to a point today where I again attribute meditation to 90 or 95% of my solution, mindfulness and techniques like what Dr. Dan was talking about. The reason I'm telling you this, A, is because we didn't finish this, and I realize you're probably wondering, and I don't talk about it very much. And B, because I, like he said, I want you to have hope. This is something where we can change the brain and change the body and change the response to understand that, you know, we're not being chased by a bear, and that we are safe, and that our fear can come in when it needs to, but it doesn't have to be anxiety all the time ruling us and determining what we do or don't do in life. Because what we want for our kids is for them to be able to have strong executive function where they can execute and go for their goals and dreams and the things that matter to them. where they can build on their strengths and their interests and their passions and their talents. And they can build a life with those types of things and feel good in life and not walk around with that worry and anxiety all the time. So anyhow, I just wanted to wrap up with that, and I will see you in the next one.